So today we'll pick up where we left off last week. So we very briefly began our discussion of instantons and non-perturbative effects in quantum field theory. So I ended Thursday's lecture by saying a few words about the decay of the false vacuum in scalar field theory. And so today we'll continue that discussion, which will probably take about half of the lecture. And then the second half of the lecture, we will move on to discuss the vacuum of non-abelian gauge theory, this chart called the theta vacua. So that discussion will probably continue over until Thursday, but we'll get as far as we can get today. So what we're interested in, if we want to study the decay of the false vacuum in scalar field theory, is a field. So for simplicity, we'll consider a scalar, real scalar, that has a canonical kinetic term and some self-interactions, which I'll call U. And we'll assume that the form of U, something like this. So that there is a local minimum, which is the false vacuum, at some field value phi f, and a true vacuum at some field value phi t. And the question we're going to ask today is if we start out in a homogeneous state where phi equals phi f everywhere, we'd expect that quantum mechanically that state is unstable due to tunneling to the true vacuum. And so what we're going to compute today is the tunneling rate, or more precisely, the tunneling rate per unit volume of bubbles of the true vacuum. If the field tried to simultaneously tunnel from phi f to phi t everywhere in all of space, what we'd find is there's no finite action solutions to do that. So that tunneling rate is zero. But there is a finite tunneling rate per unit volume for a bubble to nucleate inside of the bubble, where inside the bubble the field is near near the true vacuum. And so this is the nucleation rate per unit volume of bubbles of phi t. So schematically, what we'd expect that after the nucleation, if we're sketching, if this is two of the spatial directions, say x2 and x1, that there'll be some bubble. And inside the bubble, phi is equal to, or phi is near phi t, and outside phi is phi f. So that's the situation we're interested in. So this is after nucleation. And, well, we actually did most of the hard work of calculating this in last week's lectures. And the reason we don't have to do very much more to compute this is because the instanton method that we spent last week discussing works in any number of dimensions. So if we for we're interested in a quantum mechanical problem in two dimensions. Basically, everything I told you last week carries over directly. What we need to do is find finite action solutions to the Euclidean equations of motion. And that statement doesn't depend on the number of dimensions. And so since we can think of a field theory as like an infinite dimensional quantum mechanical system, basically we can carry over our results. And the tunneling rate per unit volume should be something like e to the minus some coefficient times e to the minus the action of a bound solution. So this is the bound solution. And this prefactor here is proportional to the determinant with the zero modes removed of S double prime. This accounts for fluctuations around our saddle points. So what's new in the field theory case? What we really need to determine is what do these bound solutions look like, and that will tell us about the tunneling rate per unit volume in scalar field theory. So one thing, our Euclidean action can be written as an integral over Euclidean time and the other spatial dimensions. And so our Euclidean action, in this case, can be written like this. And so this is just like, if we discretize this, this would just be a d-dimensional quantum mechanical system. One thing to keep in mind is that if we did do that discretization and think about the value of, of phi bar, of the field at each point in space as like one of our position variables in quantum mechanics, then the quantity that plays the role of the potential in quantum mechanics is not this U, which is also referred to as the potential in the field theory case, but these two terms together. So these two terms, the gradient term and the field theory potential, play the role of the potential V in quantum mechanics. And so this leads to some unintuitive effects and to some seeming differences between the field theory case and the quantum mechanical case in large number of dimensions. But if you just remember that this gradient term should really, if you're using the analogy, be thought of as part of the potential, that can clarify some seeming mysteries. So for example, in tutorial on Wednesday, we're going to look at a case where the potential is has a different form than this one. So where the potential U has no barrier. So you might think that there's no sense in which the field can tunnel in that case because there's no barrier in U. But actually, there can be tunneling even without a barrier in U. Because this gradient term can create a barrier in V, which is the analog of the potential that you're used to thinking about tunneling through in quantum mechanics. So we'll explore that a bit more on Wednesday. Okay, so what we need to do if we're going to study this problem is find the bound solution. And so to do that, what do we need? We need the Euclidean equations of motion, which are straightforward to write down. And we also need the boundary conditions. So let's talk about the boundary conditions first. So some of the boundary conditions we get automatically just by using our analogy with quantum mechanics. And so in the quantum mechanical problems we looked at last week, we had boundary conditions that the bounce should approach the Walls vacuum as t goes to plus or minus infinity. So our position, our path should have boundary conditions that it was in the metastable state at plus or minus infinity. That's what we saw last week. So that's the same. So this just carries over from quantum mechanics. But that's not enough of a boundary condition in order to pick out a unique solution to our Euclidean equations of motion. We need to supplement this with a boundary condition that the limit as x goes to infinity, the spatial part of our the other three coordinates, the bounce also goes to phi f if we go to infinity in any direction in Euclidean space, in order for the solution to have finite action. So this is the analog of the boundary conditions in quantum mechanics. And those boundary conditions essentially came from this same reason. Question?
Why do we expect it to be as t goes to positive infinity in the phi f state? Is it just for easiness, or?
Well, so if you recall what we did in the the problem we were looking at in quantum mechanics was a problem where the potential looks something like this. And so we were trying to solve the Euclidean equations of motion. In this case, so the Euclidean equations of motion are basically is the same thing as solving for a particle moving in an inverted potential. And if we want, the inverted potential will look something like this. And so if we want a zero energy solution that's non-trivial for a particle moving in this potential, it has to start and end here. Or the other possibility is it goes off to minus infinity, but that's not, that solution will have infinite action and won't be interesting to us. So the zero energy finite action solutions just have to have a boundary condition that it tau goes to plus or minus infinity, it's at the location of the classical local minimum.
Could you explain the second boundary condition, the comment about finite action?
Okay, so this condition is saying that, well, these two conditions together are saying that basically if we go towards infinity in any direction in Euclidean space, the bounce should approach the false vacuum solution. And that's, so if we go to hyperspherical coordinates and look at our Euclidean action, basically we want the integrand to go to zero sufficiently fast if we want this to be finite. And since u of phi bar is, well, non-zero, except for at these few locations, and the only place where the kinetic and gradient terms could be non-zero as if it approaches this. So that's basically the only possibility if we want to have finite action. And so as I just alluded to, the simplest way to solve this problem is to go to hyperspherical coordinates. And in fact, it has been shown. So the minimum value of SE is for a bounce with O4 symmetry. And this can be proved. It was first shown by Coleman and collaborators. I'm not going to go through that proof. It is true that, at least in the case we're considering, the lowest action bounce has O4 symmetry. So the simplest way to approach this problem is to work in hyperspherical coordinates. And so in hyperspherical coordinates, these two boundary conditions become the single boundary condition that the limit as rho goes to infinity of phi bar is phi f, where rho is the Euclidean radius, or hyperradius. Squared is tau squared plus x squared. Okay. And so then the equations of motion we want to solve are just the Euclidean equations of motion in hyperspherical coordinates. Here prime is the derivative with respect to the field. And well, so we've got one boundary condition so far. This is a second order differential equation. We need one other boundary condition. And so our other boundary condition will just be a regularity condition at the origin. So our other boundary condition should be just that d phi bar d rho evaluated at rho equals 0 is 0. So this is the system of equations we want to solve, or the equation and boundary conditions we want to solve. And well, we can again use our intuition from classical mechanics to get some intuition for what these solutions should look like. So this equation of motion, again, looks like a equation of motion for a particle moving in some inverted potential. But there's one difference from the quantum mechanics case. We have this extra term here, which looks like a damping term. So this is a damping term. And so this equation is like equation of motion for the position phi bar of a particle moving in a potential minus u with a time or rho dependent damping. So this is just an analogy, but hopefully I have some intuition for how to solve this classical mechanics problem. So what we want to do, well, let's sketch what the inverted potential looks like and think about what form the solution to this equation takes. So I'll label both the true and the false vacuum, and I'll also label this classical turning, or so if there's no damping, this would be the classical turning point. So a particle starting here with negligible velocity would come here, turn around. So this is the other point where the energy is zero. Okay, so we're trying to solve this equation with an unusual set of boundary conditions, at least from the classical physics perspective. So we've got, instead of initial conditions, we have boundary conditions. We've got a condition at rho equals zero. So we're thinking of rho as like a time. And we also have some final boundary condition as rho goes to infinity. So we're constraining just the velocity of the particle in this analogy at rho equals zero, but not the position. And we want it to reach where it started, reach phi f as rho goes to infinity. So we don't know where the particle starts. We just know it starts with zero velocity. And well, it's finding the general solution to this equation is hard, but it's not too hard to argue that a solution always exists. And let me just give you that argument. So we don't know what the initial position is. Or in other words, we don't know what phi bar of 0 is. And in general, it's not going to be equal to phi t. So it's easy to see that we can construct a solution that doesn't quite reach phi f. If we start, so for instance, if we start with phi bar of 0 equal to phi star, well, if there's no damping, it would reach phi f. There's a damping term, so it's going to slow down, and it's never going to reach phi f if it starts at phi star or anywhere to the left of phi star. So if phi bar of 0 is phi star, the damping will cause it to undershoot. So it never reaches phi f, and our final boundary condition is that phi bar of infinity is phi f. Okay, so we've constructed a solution where phi bar of infinity doesn't reach phi f. We can also construct what's known as an overshooting solution. So for the overshooting solution, let's start phi bar of 0 to be very close to phi t. So if it starts very close to phi t, the gradient is going to be very small if it starts sufficiently close. So it's not going to, can maintain a very small velocity for a long time. And this damping term is time dependent, and it decreases as our time, or rho, increases. So if our field spends enough time, or our particle spends enough time near phi t, it can wait until the damping term is negligible. And then the particle will just move here, losing a negligible amount of energy, and roll over phi f. And so by continuity, there has to be a solution that's somewhere in between. So if we start phi somewhere in between phi star and phi t, for some particular value, we'll satisfy our final boundary condition. So this is a special property of the scalar field theory tunneling without gravity. For instance, if you add gravity, this argument breaks down, and there can be situations where no such solution exists. But even though we didn't find an analytic solution, which is hard to do in general, we did show that this type of bound solution always exists. And a field that's initially in a homogeneous state at phi f can always decay semi-classically to some through the nucleation of bubbles to phi t. And there's one limit in which you can compute the tunneling rate, or at least the bounce action, analytically, which is known as the thin wall limit. I think Ruth told you a bit about this limit, so I'll just briefly discuss this. And so the thin wall limit is if u of phi t is approximately the same as u of by f. So in that case, we expect that the solution looks something like this. Here's phi bar as a function of rho. So in that case, phi star and phi t are approximately the same thing. And so the field is going to have to start somewhere near phi t and somewhere in between these two, but they're approximately the same. So, and phi t, in this case, or u of phi t won't be very different from u of phi f, so the particle won't be able to lose very much energy, so it's going to have to stay near phi t or phi star for a long time, and then it will quickly roll over to phi f, where it will, so it's supposed to be smooth, then remain. So this is what phi looks like as a function of rho. Or if we were to sketch what the field profile looked like after nucleation, it would look something like this sketch over here. So inside some radius, the field would be approximately phi t. There'd be some bubble wall where the field was interpolating between phi t and phi f, and outside it would look like phi f. And so the Euclidean action in this case takes a very simple form. So we just get a contribution from the potential term inside the bubble. So here, this is the radius of the bubble. And epsilon is the difference in potential energy density between phi f and phi t. So this is a volume term. And then there'll be some contribution from the gradient energy on the surface of the bubble, which will be 2 pi squared r naught cubed sigma, and sigma here is the tension of the bubble wall, which is integral from phi f to phi t d phi square root of 2v. This is a surface term. And then, the radius of the bubble will be that will be most likely to be nucleated will be the one that minimizes the Euclidean action. And so, if we said ds d re r not equal to zero. That tells us that R naught has to be 3 sigma over epsilon, and we get the Euclidean action, and this limit is 27 pi squared sigma to the fourth over 2 epsilon cubed. And so this comes back, looking at this form where we have some analytic control, comes back to the point I made last week that in many cases, we don't really care about the prefactor. I mean, sometimes it's important, but to see that, well, at least sometimes it's not important, we can just look at this Euclidean action. And we see that it depends as the fourth power of sigma and 1 over the third power of epsilon. So a mild hierarchy of scales in the problem can cause this factor to be, it depends, is the fourth or third power the appropriate quantity. So you change something to the fourth power by a factor of 2. That causes a large enhancement in the Euclidean action or a large suppression in the tunneling rate. And so this prefactor already is fairly large. 27 pi squared over 2 is approximately 100. And so the prefactor, this A over here, in a sense, tells us what units to use. E to the minus SC is dimensionless. And the ratio of the Planck volume, Planck length, the ratio of the Hubble volume to the Planck volume is about E to the 560. So this doesn't, sigma to the fourth over epsilon cube doesn't need to be that large in order for it not to matter what units you use in front.
Is the expression for tension?
Yes.
The root 2v, is that the phi that includes the gradient?
This should have been a u, thank you. Should.
Why is that the tension?
So this term here is the contribution of this kinetic and gradient terms on the bubble wall. So those terms will be large if our solution takes this form. And so what you would need to do in order to show that is basically compute these terms. So these terms will give you some contribution to the action. And they're in a thin shell. So the surface area of that shell is this. And so whatever, if you compute those terms, whatever else the coefficient is, will be the, you can interpret that as a tension. And so if you compute that, what you'd find is this. I haven't gone through the calculation, but I can point it out to you in some notes if you like. That's what you would do. OK. And so the last thing I want to say about the decay of the false vacuum is what happens to these solutions. These bounces after nucleation. So in order to determine what happens after nucleation, we can just take our bound solution and rotate back to real time. And in that case, our O4 symmetric solution will become O31 symmetric. And the radius of the bubble will become time dependent. And time dependence will just be given by the square root of t squared plus r naught squared. This just comes from rotating these solution that tau squared plus r of tau squared equals r naught squared. So weak rotation of that gives us this equation. And so what do we see? What we see from this expression is that if we look at r of t as a function of t, so the bubble will nucleate with some finite radius, and then the bubble walls will expand, will accelerate away from each other. And the velocity of the bubble walls asymptotically approaches the speed of light. So for t more than about r naught, dr dt is approximately 1. So these bubbles will, even though initially just some small region of space tunnels, after nucleation the bubbles will expand. If you wait long enough, any point in space will eventually either tunnel or be tunneled to the true vacuum, or the field will tunnel elsewhere and expand, so that at all points in space the field will reach the true vacuum. And again, this story will change if you include gravity, but in the absence of gravity, this tunneling will always complete if we wait long enough. Are there any further questions on this topic? So we'll be moving on to something slightly different. The next thing I want to discuss are the theta vacua of non-abelian gauge theory. So be studying Euclidean, for the most part, non-abelian gauge theory. And the question we're going to ask is, what is the vacuum state? And so what we're going to find is that classically, our theory will have a large or an infinite number of classically degenerate vacua, just like the periodic potential we studied last week. And instanton effects are going to break that degeneracy. And so what we're going to be studying today and next time is what instantons can tell us about what the vacuum state of non-abelian gauge theory looks like. Okay. And, well, I'm going to be using the convention that the metric is all positive. You might be asking why I'm telling you this, but unfortunately in this subject, particularly in the early literature, lots of people chose the other convention. So some of the signs may disagree with some of the references that you can look at, but this is, to me, the only natural choice of metric. Okay, so the first question, if we want to study the vacuum state of the quantum theory, a simpler question to ask first is what are the classical vacua look like? And so the classical vacua we expect are just given by gauge field configurations that are zero, or at least zero up to some gauge transformation. So if A mu is I times U d mu U inverse, this configuration is pure gauge. And so it has vanishing field strength. And we expect that it has, and it can be shown that this has zero energy. All right, so in order to understand what the classical vacua, or the minimum energy classical solutions are, we need to understand what are the possible pure gauge field configurations. And what we're going to show is the set of pure gauge field configurations is not connected, or at least not for all choices of the dimension of space-time and all choices of gauge group. So in particular, for any non-abelian gauge theory in D equals 4, this statement will be true. It's also true for abelian gauge theory in D equals 2. And so that tells us, this statement here, that the set of pure gauge field configurations is not connected, tells us if we want to move from some pure gauge configuration with zero energy to another one, we may have to deform the field into some gauge field configuration that's not pure gauge, and so that a gauge field configuration that's not pure gauge, we'd expect has non-zero energy and would have positive energy. So this suggests, this tells us that there should be barriers between degenerate minima, just like the periodic potential. And so just like the periodic potential in quantum mechanics, tunneling through these barriers will lead to splitting of the degeneracy. And in order to figure out how that happens, what we need to do is we need to find the instanton configurations that mediate tunneling between these degenerate vacua. So need to find the instantons. So our Euclidean action, in this case, is just the one you're familiar with from QFT2, except with the plus sign because we're in Euclidean space. And so what we're looking for are finite action solutions to the Euclidean equations of motion. And so if we were looking for finite action solutions, we need F mu nu to vanish quickly enough as we go to infinity. Just like our argument for the boundary conditions in tunneling in scalar field theory. So finite Euclidean action tells us that F mu nu should go to zero as rho goes to infinity. And in particular, it should go to zero faster than 1 over rho squared. So we want this integral to be finite. We do it in hyperspherical coordinates. And so that tells us that f mu nu should be order 1 over rho cubed, except for assume it has some integer scaling. And, well, it tells us what we're really interested in is what the gauge fields look like for our instantons. And so this tells us that A mu should be order 1 over r squared. Rho squared, sorry. Because we take derivatives of the gauge field in order to get the field strength. But we know that we have a gauge symmetry. So if we have any field configuration that goes to zero sufficiently quickly as large Euclidean radius, so should that will give us a field strength that vanishes sufficiently quickly. But so should any gauge transformation of a field strength that gauge field that goes to zero sufficiently quickly. So our gauge field should be something that dies away quickly up to a gauge transformation. And we like our gauge transformations to be well defined at infinity. So that means that u should be order rho to the zero. So it should be a function of angles only as rho goes to infinity.
Sorry, maybe yes. An irrelevant question, but you said that f needs to go to zero faster than 1 over rho squared.
Right.
Then we say that it has to be O big O of rho to the minus cubed.
Yes.
Isn't it enough for it to go faster to zero than 1 over rho squared to just be like 2 plus epsilon, not necessarily 3? Is there a reason why we're prohibiting fractional powers?
At this point, no. It turns out we won't be able to, the simplest solutions will have integer powers. So, but Yeah, there's no reason that 2 plus epsilon wouldn't work at this level analysis. Yes?
Could you explain again why you should be...
So we just want it to be well-defined as on the boundaries. So it should have a well-defined limit as rho goes to infinity.
And so the gauge term doesn't need to be order 1 over rho squared?
This term, no, it doesn't. So it should be a gauge transformation of something that's order 1 over rho squared. But this term... this term won't contribute to F, but it could go to 0 more slowly than 1 over rho squared. Okay, so we see that every finite action solution, or every finite action configuration, is associated with some U. It's not necessarily unique. So let's see if we can always get rid of, if we could always get rid of this term by gauge transformation, then it wouldn't be important. We could just, by some suitable gauge transformation, get rid of this term and only consider gauge fields that go to 0, like 1 over rho squared. So if we do a gauge transformation on a gauge field that takes this form, if we take A mu to H A mu H inverse plus I H D mu H inverse, and assume that our starting A had this form, this takes us to gauge field that has the following form, and we still have the 1 over rho squared term piece. And so if we could choose h so that hu is equal to 1 as rho goes to infinity, we could remove the first term. This is not possible in general. So we can't we generally cannot find a gauge transformation that can remove this term. And so to see why, so we'll come back to the non-abelian case in D equals 4 on Thursday. But to see why, we'll look at the simpler case of abelian gauge theory in two dimensions for the remainder of today. It will work very similarly to the D equals 4 non-abelian case. So this is U1 and D equals 2. So the same arguments we had before, tell us that, well, they change our counting slightly, but the arguments are the same. So the gauge field strength should go like 1 over r squared. The gauge field itself should be order 1 over r up to gauge transformations. And if we want u to be a function only of the angles as rho goes to infinity, then u should be just a function. There's only one angle in two dimensions, so it should just take the form e to the I times some function of theta. And so what we're interested in studying are maps from the circle which is the circle at r equals infinity in Euclidean two-dimensional space. So that's what this angle theta parameterizes. And we're mapping the circle to the circle, which is another way of thinking about the group U1. And there are a set of standard maps that we can use to map the circle to itself. The first such map, which I'll call U0, it's just a trivial map, maps everything to the identity. There's also a map that is the identity map. It maps every point on the circle infinity to the corresponding point on the circle U1. And we can generalize this and construct a map that has a nu here. And this map, or these class of maps, wind around the circle n times. So this map maps everything in the range from 0 to 2 pi over nu to the full circle of U1, and from 2 pi over nu to 4 pi over nu maps that again to the full circle. So these maps wind nu times around the circle. So here we're assuming that nu is an integer. And it can be shown that any map from S1 to S1 is continuously deformable to 1 and only one of these maps. And this in other words, it's homotopic to one and only one of these maps. And so this illustrates what the obstruction is. So if we have some u that has, say, some winding number, then in general it's not possible to continuously deform that u to, say, the trivial map. And so if we remain so it's not possible to map every gauge field configuration of this form to every other gauge field configuration of this form. Or if we ignore this term, that tells us it's not possible to map, to continuously deform every pure gauge configuration to every other pure gauge configuration, there are topological obstructions to deforming some such configurations into others. So I'm essentially out of time. But where we're going next time is we will see that, well, first of all, we'll examine some other properties of these maps. So I'll give you some other useful ways of thinking about this winding number. And then we'll generalize this to D equals 4 and non-abelian gauge theory, where most of what I've told you has very close analogs. So that's where we'll go next time. And probably begin studying anomalies as well. Katie.